We're continuing with Sri Brahma Samhita, and we'll be covering this morning verses 34 and 35. And these verses 34 and 35 are part of a group of four. Again, just a quick overview. The first three verses, 29, 30, 31, are Lord Brahma's disclosure of the spiritual world and the form of Krishna, the pastimes of Krishna that he realized through his process of chanting of mantra. Gopal mantra, Kam Gayatri mantra. Those things we heard in the previous Thanksgiving session, because the process of his realization was in detail presented and discussed. Now these Govinda prayers are his sharing or expression of his realizations of the ocean of truth. And to be even more specific, it's not just, hey, I've got an idea, I think it's like this. Rather, he was seeing the spiritual world. He was seeing the form of Krishna. He was experiencing the pastime of Krishna. And he sent back some signals. He had a very good broadcaster. We just have to have a good receiver to receive those. It's not just information, but if we, as Prabhupada recommended, enter into the spirit of the hymn, we can actually experience what Lord Brahma experienced. We discussed this. This again, this is review. The mantra upasana process, several times we've discussed. The Gayatri mantra is received by Lord Brahma. The verses 29 and 31, two of the verses, 30 and 32, these, yes, these are verses that are mantra upasana type. Not that the other verses are second class and something like that. They're specific, though, specifically qualified to help us achieve that blissful outcome of experiencing Krishna's pastimes. And when we get to text 56, which is the final verse that we'll be covering, so that's going to be Sunday night, that's a Sva Rasaki type, according to Jiva Goswami. That's the river, and you enter into the river and you can experience, you can participate in Krishna's pastimes. How valuable is this subject matter, this literature of Sri Brahma Samhita? So we'll chant this verse, do a little review of verses 32-33, where they fit into this picture. And then we'll carry on with these next two verses. So, Govinda Vani Prabhu. And the translation, hopefully this works. Translation. I worship Govinda. How about you? The primeval Lord. Only the tip of the toe of whose lotus feet is approached by the yogis who aspire after the transcendental and betake themselves to pranayama by drilling the respiration, or by the gyanis who try to find out the non-differentiated Brahman by the process of elimination of the mundane, extending over thousands and millions of years. Maybe you remember from verses 3 through 5, especially verse 5 of Brahma Samhita, which describes there's the lotus with Krishna and Radha in the center, and then the abode of Radha and Krishna is at the whorl, the corolla of the lotus, and then the petals are the abodes of the gopis. Hundreds of thousands of gopis, that's a lot of gopis. And then the abodes of the other associates of Krishna, that's the lotus, and then there's the suburbs, or the area outside the world of the lotus. And it was depicted in the diagram as white because its name is Sweta Dvipa. And in that Sweta Dvipa region, there's many, 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 many things that are identified in verse 5. And one of them is tridents in the 10 directions. You know what tridents do? People that are not qualified to try to go there, they get them. So the yogis and the gyanis, they don't even actually get to the toe. They get tridented before they even get there. And of the verses of Brahma Samhita, I've not done any numerical research, but just hearing Prabhupada's lectures again and again, there are certain verses that he would repeat again and again most. One of them is Premanjana Charita Bhakti Vilochanena, that one coming up. And this one, because our pranam mantra for Srila Prabhupada, when we offer obeisances, we say our pranam mantra. And the second one is Srila Prabhupada was specifically dedicated in his writings, in his life, in his gift to the world, to relieve his audience from the perils of impersonalism and voidism. Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Pasyata Deshatadine. So, those who are impersonalists have no place in the kingdom of love, in Goloka Vrindavan. So he would repeat many times, making reference to this verse. Go back to the Sanskrit. Tantastu koti shata batsara sampagamyo. This is over. Koti shata, thousands of millions. Koti shata. Vatsara, years. Samragamyo. So he would say, supposing you could have a vimana, a craft, a spacecraft, that can travel as fast as the wind, or as fast as the mind. What's the sound that's as fast as the mind? Soundless. And then he would say, for example, supposing I'm sitting here in Los Angeles and I think of Calcutta. At once the mind is there. How fast is that? The speed of the mind. And if you can build a craft that's the speed of the mind, and for thousands of millions of years, zoom, 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 that fast, still, the abode of Krishna is far beyond. Meaning, the mind cannot touch, because the mind is a material element. How can a material element touch the spiritual world? Answer, it cannot. The mind cannot. So supposing you're a meditator, yogi, as the verse says, following the pranayama system. So vayor, that's wind, atapi manaso, that's the mind. Muni Pungavana, the foremost of Gyanis. Munis and Gyanis. So whether you're an empiricist, as he's translated this, by the process of elimination of the mundane, maybe you've familiar or have heard of this process, the neti-neti process. Not iti means not this. Not iti, it's not this. What's transcendence? Well, it's not this, and it's not this, and it's not this, and it's not this. By the process of not this, neti-neti process, what are you going to get? You're going to get nothing. So you either become, the conclusion is, Nirvishesha or Shunyavada. The absolute is impersonal. Because here there's personality, so the absolute must be without person. Here there's variety. The absolute must be without variety. And so forth. Here we have arms and legs and a head. The absolute has no head, has no face, has no personality, has no qualities. How insulting. You understand? How insulting. Your mother has no face. She has no personality. Excuse me. You're rude. Don't talk about my mother like that. Yeah, she has no form. That's a New York accent. It's insulting. And so, one who loves Krishna is insulted. They don't want to hear this rude talk. So, Prabhupada would get excited. Bhujan told me a story. This is story time. He was in Hong Kong, and Prabhupada was going to be visiting Hong Kong. So he wanted a nice forum for Prabhupada to speak. So he, Bhurijan, found out, and he's written this in My Glorious Master, if you want to look into detail. I'm probably going to get it not exactly correct, but the gist of it is there. So Bhurijan found out there was going to be a public event where a Swami from India was going to speak. Guess what type he was? Marvati. And he had a following in Hong Kong. So Prabhupada was not yet known for being Nirvishesha Shunyavadi. He was like unknown in Hong Kong. So Bhurijan approached them, the organizers, and said, would you be willing to have another Swami also speak at this event so we have an audience? And they said, sure. But your Swami can speak first and keep it this, then our Swami will speak. So when they got there, there was a big seat and a little seat. Guess who the big seat was attended for? And guess where Prabhupada sat? On the big seat. And then the organizers trying to, you know, politely indicate, don't sit on the big seat, that's for our Swami, sit on this little seat over here. Prabhupada didn't pay attention. He didn't budge. So there, when their Swami came later, he sat on the little seat. And then the narration goes, Prabhupada spoke, and he spoke very beautifully about bhakti, and, like, you know, through the medium of devotional service to Krishna, one can understand Krishna as a person, and, you know, Krishna conscious message. He kept within the time allotted, and then the other Swami spoke, and he spoke in Hindi. Burijan said, I couldn't understand, but I could, from the facial expression of Prabhupada, I could understand what the man was saying. You know, God has no face, he has no personality, he has no qualities, he's, you know, a blob. Or, you know, the impersonal Brahmajyoti. And Prabhupada's hand was clenched and shaking. And Burijan didn't know what was going to happen. And all of a sudden, Prabhupada blurted out, and his microphone was still there, and blasted the man and got up and walked out. Of the assembly. Because it's rude, it's insulting, one who you love saying such things. I forget, there was some exchange afterwards with the place where Prabhupada was staying. Burijan asked, what did he say? And he said he was speaking of Krishna in these ways and couldn't take it. Couldn't just sit there in heaven, speak like that. Nirvishesha Shunyavad. So this verse Prabhupada referred to again and again and again and again in his delivering this message, that not by the neti neti process, not by negation of the mundane, or elimination of the mundane, do it for thousands of millions of years, and you'll never be able to understand Krishna, or be a yogi, and travel by astral travel, and zoom, zoom, all over the place. You can't go to Krishna. You won't reach the tip of the toe. Now, you remember this phrase, we'll go back. So pyasti yat prapada sinya avachinchatate. We're going to make reference to this after breakfast in the first verse of the next section. So there's a connection between this section and the next section. And this is establishing, you'll hear, that the goal is to attain shelter in Krishna. The goal of the whole Vedic process is to attain shelter in Krishna, at shelter of his lotus feet. What does that mean, lotus feet? It means engaged in his humble service. That's what attaining shelter of his lotus feet means in practical terms. We engage in his loving service in a humble mood. That's the goal. And we're cultivating that. So what the next section will build on this verse. So let's just do a real quick review of what these four verses are doing, starting with 32 and 33, which we covered yesterday. Now 34, 35. What's the role in the whole of Brahma Samhita? So these four verses are Brahma giving his audience, us, relief from any doubts we might have as to how it can be that Krishna does the things he does, his pastimes. How can we understand the form of Krishna is what it says his form is, how can we understand that his abode, his dham, has countless numbers of goddesses of fortune and all the things that it says in verse 29? How is it? So that when we hear the glories of Krishna, the doubt is removed. We can actually access transcendence. Because as we know, in Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna is playing the role like one of us. He's not like one of us. But Krishna arranges that he can play the role like one of us. And what does Arjuna do? He presents his doubts. It's perfectly okay that there's a doubt, and then you present the doubt so that the doubt can be removed. It's okay. Present the doubt so the doubt can be removed. So in Brahma Samhita, it's much shorter. That's 700 verses, it's 62. So the doubt is not articulated. It's not a verse saying, yeah, but. It's just anticipating or knowing that persons who hear the pastimes of Krishna, the abode of Krishna, and the form of Krishna is fully transcendental, like impersonalists, they go, no. He's formless. So, for such people, these four verses are there to explain how it is possible. It's not specifically, it's not imagination, and it's not unwholesome. This becomes really important in the next section, so I've been emphasizing it repeatedly. So it starts with, there's this refrain, text 32, if you remember from the beginning. Ananda chinmaya sarujvala vigrahasya. So that phrase, ananda chinmaya sad, it appears in verse 1. It's a theme-like presentation in verse 32 and this section. And it appears again in the next section in relation to his pastimes. So, it's important. It's, I'm not a Sanskrit scholar, but my understanding of how Srila Prabhupada would use certain verses, how Vyasadeva would use certain phrases and repeat them, and then repeat them, and then repeat them. It means it's important. It's thematic. Just like if you're, you're a mother or a father, and you're trying to teach a child something, you may say something over and over again. And over and over again. And over and over again, because it's really important. It's part of training, imparting culture and character and quality. Something repeated over and over again. So this is transcendental instruction, where similarly, it's important. And then even just even just hearing the phrase, the whole picture opens up because you've heard it over and over again. Our acharyas do that when they refer to certain verses and just, a little phrase from that certain verse. And then the whole picture is there because they've spoken it again and again. So, Brahma Samhita has this phrase, Ananda Chinmaya Sad, or Sat, Satchitananda. It's totally different than this place. This place is asat, not sat, temporary. It's not, our body is not full of knowledge. The soul is the place of consciousness. When the soul leaves the body, it's dead matter. Like Rukmini, we read what she said. These foolish ladies that become attracted to a dead body with hairs and mustaches and beards and flesh and bones and mucus and stool and urine, and think that's nice. Not me. your body is Satchitananda. I don't want to marry anyone but you. Please rescue me. Imagine having that realization and inviting Krishna to come and marry you. Pretty cool. So, Brahma Samhita wants to impart this understanding. And so, the first verse, 32 of this group of four, is because with the understanding that Krishna's form is Sachit Ananda, Ujjvala Vigraha, full of dazzling splendor. Because his body is absolute, any part of his body is the same as any other part of his body, and he can do anything through any part of his body. You heard this nice explanation. It's not like he has a body, but he is. Like we have a body, but Krishna doesn't have a body in the same way that we have a body. Krishna is his form. And because of that absolute nature, one limb can do anything any other limb can do. And it's not imaginative, it's his it's an aspect or character of his transcendental form. And then, yesterday evening we heard about the apparently contradictory features of Krishna, like he's the oldest, but he never gets old. He's eternally youthful. And other apparent contradictions, and if you remember, this is important to understand the nature of Krishna and, you know, how Krishna can do what he does. The explanation given was, Krishna is made up of innumerable, inconceivable, mutually contradictory potencies. And Krishna can exhibit this potency and then withdraw it. He can exhibit that potency and then withdraw it. And it looks like, wait a minute, this is a contradiction. So, how are these contradictions to be resolved? Apparent contradictions? Irreconcilable attributes? By recognizing that Krishna has these inconceivable potencies, and he draws upon them, and we can understand them through the Vedas that are imbued with Ladini Shakti and Sambhit Shakti, or his ecstatic potency and his spiritual cognitive potency. And when you put those two together, you get devotional service. I'll say it again. Do it the other way. Devotional service happens when we become the recipient of this wonderful gift from Krishna of his Ladini Shakti, that's Radharani, her mercy. And with Radharani, she has cognitive potency too. We get her mercy, we get a devotional service. A devotional service isn't going to happen otherwise. You can't, like, climb a ladder and get up there to devotional service. It's bestowed. It's descending mercy. The climbing the ladder thing is this verse 34. Become a dhyani and zoom, zoom. Or a mystic yogi and zoom, zoom. You're never going to get there. It's descending mercy. And so devotees are naturally humble and they want mercy. They want descending mercy of Krishna and the Vaishnavas and the holy name. They're not like lazy, very active, but active in a mood of eagerness, just like one of the questions yesterday evening. Eagerness to receive, to be situated in that relationship once again. I don't want to be flapping out there on my own, trying to be an enjoyer of fruitive activities and material happiness that's phantasmagoria. I don't want that. I want my relationship with Krishna, please. Krishna. Like that. And Krishna's mercy comes. He's very loving. Just like universal, all over the world, doesn't matter what culture, doesn't matter anything, embodiment, socioeconomic status, color, anything. A child does this. Everybody knows what it means. Universal language. Mommy, please pick me up. And the child wants to feel the comfort and shelter and protection of their mother or their father. That's all. Just being acknowledged and being offered that shelter. And then, so the child is in the mother's arms and he looks at daddy and holds his arms out to daddy. He wants that same thing from daddy, and then daddy takes him in his arms. And in about 30 seconds, he's wiggling and wants to go run around again. Because he's been acknowledged and shelter's been given, and now I can go and have fun, knowing that I'm under the shelter and the protection of my mother and father. You know, in some, whatever it is, 20 minutes later, it's the same thing. Universal. And it's not like anybody else can pick up the child. It's mommy and daddy. Somehow, the child knows. After some time, others will become very, very close to mommy and daddy. Then they're okay too, but it's like because of their connection with mommy and daddy, it's not otherwise. Isn't it? Universal. Doesn't matter what the culture is, where in the world you are. Similarly, we're part and parcel of Krishna. And until we do that, we're going to cry, feel unsheltered and running around looking for happiness and pleasure and, conquering the challenges of life and fending off the obstacles and, living as a materialist without shelter. There's no happiness there. So, this verse, 33, is another very important verse where Vedeshu Durlabham Adurlabham Adabhaktam is stated. So that's just review. And now we're going on to this morning's 34. That is Krishna's form, his Vigraha, once again. Notice that this is 32, 33, 34. They're all about Krishna's form. His form is unapproachable by other means. 33 says, by bhakti alone. 34 says, not by other means. Not by jnana. Not by mystic yoga. And then 35 is another very important verse to help us understand, remove doubts of how Krishna can be like he is. It's the relationship between Krishna and Krishnas. That is to say, Prabhupada would express, in all of creation there's only two things, Krishna and Krishnas. There's not a third thing. Then he would say, there's no void in the creation of God. Again, this is the voidist conception being dismissed. Void means there's nothing. Nothingness. And the statement, positive statement, is there's Krishna and there's Krishnas and there's not a third thing. There's no void in the creation of God. There's something where there's nothing. It's imagination, something where there's nothing. There's Krishna and there's Krishna. So what's the relationship between all things and Krishna? The relationship of its inseparableness, yet Krishna is one entity, and he's a person. And his personhood is not dependent upon his energies. His energies are dependent upon personhood, or the being the personality of God. So, Achintya Veda, Veda Tattva, we'll be discussing that. So, let us go on. Here's this statement of, in summary of what 34 is saying. We cannot understand God or religion by the process of mental speculation or the mystic yoga system. I know somebody, a Western person, who is really enthusiastic. They're practicing Ashtanga Yoga. I didn't right away, like, get a hammer out and hammer them, but I you know, it's best with such persons to add the holy name. Take the holy name along with your Ashtanga Yoga process, and oh, here's some prasada, and oh, here's the Bhagavad Gita. It's taught about chapter 6. Check it out. The hammers right away isn't a good idea. Even though moving in a craft, a traveling vehicle at the speed of the mind or the wind, still the absolute truth remains inconceivable. There's these two processes mentioned. The yoga process, look at that painting of the Gyani. The Gyani process. Do you know some people that are like bookworms? There's this man that's been coming to the Brooklyn Temple, I don't know, for 30 years. Every Sunday. And he carries a bag. And in the bag is a pile of books. So he's sitting there during RT reading his book, sitting there during class reading his book, sitting there during announcements reading the book, time for prasadam, he takes his bag downstairs and he's reading his book. And he has some empty containers. So it's not only he takes prasadam, but he takes prasadam home for the week, I think. So as he's reading his book, he doesn't have to interrupt his reading or cooking or something like that. Because cooking for Krishna is like not on his radar screen, it's just reading the book. But that process of jnana, I'm sure he's becoming purified by just sitting in the RT, even though he's not paying attention to it, reading his book, and taking all that prasadam all week long. But by the process of jnana alone, the absolute truth cannot be approached in the process of yoga. But it can be understood by the grace of unalloyed devotion. It matches the previous verse, 33, but 34 is saying, not this, not this, not by the process of yoga again. And rather, it's only pure devotees who can enter into the spiritual world. This is Shukadeva Goswami instructing Maharaj Pariksit on the bank of the Ganges, where the sages are some seated under that large banyan tree in the background and others assembled as Shukadeva Goswami is speaking. By receiving bhakti from one who is a bhakta, one can become spiritually equipped not only to remove material conceptions, but to receive the proper spiritual conception through the medium of bhakti and go back to Godhead. Nice painting from Brihat Bhagavatamrita, that person being embraced by Krishna, that's Gopakumar. And he goes back to Godhead. Similarly, by chanting the same Gopal mantra, it's called in Brihat Bhagavatamrita the Madan Gopal mantra. That is the same as Gopal mantra mentioned earlier in verse 3, then again in verse 34. Govindam There he is with the cows. Adi Purusham. There he is. There's the original person who is Mahavishnu. This is Garbhadakshay Vishnu, reclining on Anantashesh, the original person of this material creation. Tamaham Bhajami. Srila Prabhupada paying obeisances before the deities in Australia. On the right is that Madhavisa Prabhu, who not so long ago left this world. There was a big ceremony in Los Angeles for him. Okay, so that's verse 34. One more in this section is verse 35. This is high tech here.
Eko Kriso Chaitam Jagrat Kodhi Yash Shakti Rasti Jagrat Chayaya Lama Andhata Rasta Paramat Chayanta Rasta Govinda Vali Krishna Ambujani Govinda Vali Krishna Ambujani.
So the translation. He, we know who he is, that's Govinda. He is an undifferentiated entity. Bhakti Siddhanta's language. He is an undifferentiated entity. He's absolute. Here, things are relative truths. He is an undifferentiated entity. He is the absolute truth. As there is no distinction between potency and the possessor of the potency. So this is emphasis on the oneness between the potent and the potency. There's a relationship of oneness, like the sunshine and the sun. You can't separate. Will not find shine somewhere without the sun from which the shine comes. Or won't find a sun without sunshine. So there's emphasis in this particular beginning part of the non-difference, no distinction between. Then in his work of creation of millions of worlds, his potency remains inseparable. So there's a time discussed in the earlier verses of Brahma Samhita where the potencies of the Supreme Lord are withdrawn, cosmic annihilation. Not only they're withdrawn, they're in this undifferentiated state, meaning, using some common expression, a big warehouse where everything's all jumbled up. You can't tell this from that. There's no distinction between earth, water, fire, air, ether. Everything is in its subtle and dormant, undifferentiated state. Where those energies are in a relationship of oneness with him. Then comes creation. And the universes are distributed throughout space, throughout the spiritual, throughout the Mahatattva, within the spiritual sky. In that case, also, his potency remains inseparable, a relationship of oneness. Then, all the universes exist in him. Notice the contradiction. All the universes exist in him, and he is present in fullness in every one of the atoms that are scattered throughout the universe at one and the same time. I'm sure you picked up on the contradiction. Such is the primeval Lord whom I adore. So this is discussing the Achintya Bhed, Abhed, difference and non-difference, reality or tattva about Krishna. Simultaneous oneness and difference between all existence and its source of emanation was propounded by Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and presented elaborately, followed by his followers, the Acharyas, following his line. The painting, most of you are familiar with the pastime, the painting illustrated here is Krishna, who is seated having his lunch, and when Lord Brahma kidnapped, he stole the calves or cows and tucked them away in a cave. So the cowherd boys were having their lunch, became concerned, the calves are missing. And Krishna said, don't worry, you continue having the lunch, I'll find the calves. So Krishna went to look for the calves. When Krishna went to look for the calves, Brahma came back to the scene of the crime, and he took all the cowherd boys and put them in a cave. Ha ha, now let's see what Krishna is going to do. And he came back. And there he saw Krishna seated with all the cowherd boys having lunch. What happened? I put them in the cave. He went back in the cave, and they were in the cave. Then he went back to where they were having lunch, and he saw all the cowherd boys, and suddenly all the cowherd boys became transformed into, each one of them, forms of Narayana. And each of the forms of Narayana, each one, surrounded by a host of demigods and personified Vedas, chanting hymns of glorification of the Supreme Lord. The whole cosmic manifestation surrounding each of those forms of the Lord, and then all of a sudden, poof, they all disappeared. Brahma realized that the replica cowherd boys and calves were forms of Narayana, exactly resembling the forms of the cowherd boys and calves that were put in the cave, because Krishna manifested both. One was the living entity, the jiva soul, within a actually their spiritual form, manifesting their spiritual form, and then it's Narayana who can manifest identical form. No problem. So all of that is within Krishna. And Krishna may exhibit it, or he may not exhibit it. And then again exhibit it, and then not exhibit it, then transform something. Because everything is within him. And the relationship between everything and him is this. Achintya means inconceivable, so that means, like the previous verse, the mind can't zoom, let me figure it out. By the process of speculation, it can't be approached by the mind. Stretch the mind. It'll snap before you get there. However elastic and flexible your mind is, it can't encompass or touch spiritual reality. They have this expression in English, wrap your mind around it. You can't wrap your mind around it. Can't even come close. For thousands and millions of years of trying to get your mind around it, not going to happen. Beyond, it's another realm. That's why this is spiritual realm. So, at the same time, everything is within Krishna. He's separate because he's continuing his pastimes in Goloka Vrindavan. He's not like information overload with everything that's going on everywhere in all the creations and all the universes. It would be pretty disturbing for his pastimes if that was the case. So he's everywhere present, and he's only present in the spiritual world. He has this Bhagavan future. By his inconceivable power, he can at will create numberless universes. All the mundane universes owe their origin to the transformation of his external potency. At the same time, his abode is beyond human conception, since all worlds, limited and spiritual, exist in him. And it's literal. They exist in him. This first line, Eko Pyaso Rachayatam Jagadandako Tim. Again, it's in his, Krishna's work of creation of these millions of universes. The potencies are spread all over, but the potencies remain inseparable from him. As Prabhupada would say, not even a blade of grass can move without the sanction of the Supreme Lord. You can't blink your eyelid without the sanction of the Supreme Lord. You can't digest your food without the sanction of the Supreme Lord. If you take the sanction away, you have indigestion. There are all kinds of ways it can happen, not just one. Just by his will, things happen, and without his will, nothing happens. We're not independent. We're dependent, because his energies are inseparable from him. Then, the next line, yet shakti rasi jagadanda chayara chaya yagantaha. Again, this seeming contradiction. Although he is all pervasive, there isn't a place where he isn't. He's all pervasive. Yet, his existence everywhere, in a medium shape, consists his spiritual lordship beyond human conception. So, again, Bhakti Siddhanta language. What's his medium shape? What's that mean? Here's what it means. His human-like form. There's Mahavishnu, who's so big that millions of universes come from the pores of his body. How big is the pore of your body? Pretty tiny. And imagine, you know, maybe some perspiration will come out of the pore of your body. Well, for Mahavishnu, universes come out of each of the pores of his body. How big is his body? Pretty big. And that same, not alternating or vacillating back and forth, but simultaneously, he's within every atom. And then there's his medium size, that's Krishna Govinda. Within Krishna Govinda, both are there. Bigger than the biggest, smaller than the smallest, within Krishna. Wow. Cool. How's he doing? Inconceivable potency. And this pastime, one of the pastimes is this one. Mother Yashoda. And there you see in the background is Balaram. He's in whitish complexion. Balaram made a story. He conspired against Krishna and told Mother Yashoda, Krishna's eating dirt. Krishna said, I haven't eaten dirt. And Mother Yashoda didn't know what to believe. She said, okay, if you haven't eaten dirt, then you let me look inside your mouth. And let me see if you've eaten dirt. So Krishna opened up his mouth. And when Mother Yashoda looked inside Krishna's mouth, she saw everything. Not only this universe, but all the universes, and all the mountains, and all the rivers, and all the trees, and all the species of life, and all the planetary systems, She saw everything inside Krishna's mouth, including seeing Mother Yashoda looking inside Krishna's mouth, inside Krishna's mouth. Because everything is within Krishna. That's what the verse is saying. Anantarastaparamanuchayantarasam. On the left we see a painting of Paramatma. And you see those electrons zooming around because that's like an atom, and Paramatma is within every atom. Of the universes that come from his body. It's a contradiction. He's within everything and he's outside of everything. It's like we're in the temple room or we're outside of the temple room. We can't be in the temple room and outside the temple room at the same time. We cannot do that. Krishna can do that. He can be within everything and outside of everything. And everything is within him. Everything is not in here. I call this Upanishadic double talk. Those of you who are familiar with the Vedas. Like, you know, Prabhupada translated one of the Upanishads, Sri Isha Upanishad, is one of our essential devotional texts. And in that devotional text, Isha Upanishad, he's and same kind of discussion. Yeah. Within everything and outside of everything. So there's a very nice pastime that Jiva Goswami points to in this Bhagavad Sandarbha to illustrate this very same point. There's symmetry amongst our acharyas, helping us to understand the inconceivable, which is itself inconceivable. How can you understand that which is inconceivable? That would make it not inconceivable if you could understand it. Well, you can't understand it even if it's explained without bhakti. That's how it's understandable. So, he refers in this Bhagavad Sandarbha, Anuchet 29, to a particular verse in relation to the Damodar Lila. And this, the heading in that section, Anuchet 29, is the powers of Bhagavan. Powers means his potency, his shaktis. Yes? So, Bhagavan means one who possesses bhagas. He possesses opulences. And these are some of his opulences that bewilder the empiricist and delight the devotee. So, there's the reference. You can write it down if you like, or you can find a translation of Bhagavad Sandarbha, which I did. Bhanu Swami has made a translation of this. Here's the two verses. First, Nichantar na bahir yasya. Those of you that know a little bit of, like, the Nishringa prayers. Bahir Nishringo? Hridaye Nishringo. Same. He's outside and he's inside. Bahir means outside, and antar in this verse means inside. And, but vatmajam. We're going to refer back to this, the Sanskrit. Matvatmajam, matva atmajam indicates Mother Yashoda saw herself as Krishna was born from her body. Matva atmajam, jam. He took birth from her body, his mother. Anyway, avyakta, marchalingam, and hoksajam. Each of these terms, Jiva Goswami is going to point to. Here's the translation, but we'll go back to the Sanskrit. This is Shukadeva Goswami speaking about this particular pastime and explaining, as we've been doing with these four verses, how is it that Mother Jasoda tries to bind Krishna with rope, and it's 2 inches too short, so she gets more rope. No, she uses her rational faculty. By logic and reason, the rope is too short, you get another rope. Tie two ropes together, it'll go around. It's too short. Not only too short, it's the same 2 inches too short. So she gets more rope. According to Jiva Goswami, she's got kilometers of rope. Because she had no she's Nanda Maharaja's wife. He has 900,000 cows. He's got lots of rope. She got all that rope. And then she went to the storehouses of the other families in Raja and got their rope and tied the rope together. Kilometers of rope. That didn't go around. So, in explaining why it didn't go around, this is Shukadeva Goswami saying, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Govinda, has no beginning and no end, no exterior and no interior, no front and no rear. In other words, he is all pervading. So this is important. It's one of the questions that come. Well, he's all pervading, but how can the rope go around him at all? However big the rope is. He is not under the influence of the element of time. For him, there's no difference between past, present, and future. Semicolon. He exists in his own transcendental form at all times. Being absolute, beyond relativity, he is free from distinctions between cause and effect, although he is the cause and effect of everything. Notice the contradictions. That unmanifested person who is beyond the perception of the senses had now appeared as a human child, and Mother Yashoda, considering him her own ordinary child, bound him to the wood mortar with the rope, although he's all pervasive. Oh, I have to get my notes. This is making reference to this verse. Jiva Goswami in his Bhagavat Sandarbha refers to this verse. Let's see if I can find it correctly. Jiva Goswami is wonderful. And in the course of his writing, he makes some declarations. And then he allows the fact that people aren't going to necessarily believe him. And they'll present their doubt. So he has this imaginary skeptic dialogue going on. So the skeptic may say, well, wait a minute, da-da-da-da. And to that, this verse answers the da-da-da-da. And then to that, well, you say, this is the answer, but then, how about that? And to that skeptic's question, so this verse explains, well, that may be, but what about that? So that's what's going to come. And it explains this whole topic that we've been discussing. So, the phrase Jagach Chaya, you find it in that verse? At the end of the first section. Jagato Yo Jagach Chaya. The phrase Jagach Chaya means he is everything in creation in total, that's this inseparableness of the energy in itself, may be understood in the following way. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is not different from either the cause of creation, which He is, or the cosmic manifestation, that is the effect of that cause. That's eko piso. In other words, because the entire material universe is nothing but the potency of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, He is not different from it. Because an ordinary material rope, this is not the Leela, an ordinary material rope is simply a fragmental part of one of His energies, such a rope has no power to bind Him. Any more than a small flame has the power to burn a large flame. Interesting example. So that's his statement. Mother Jasoda was finding that she couldn't bind Krishna. Because who can put a rope around everything? Within Krishna is everything. Doubt. At this point, someone may raise the following objection. If the Supreme Personality of Godhead is all-pervading, then how is it possible that Yashoda Devi tied Him with a small rope that could not even have extended the breadth of the material universe? How big a rope did she buy to try to bind Krishna? Within Krishna is everything. So even just one of the universes, which is part of everything. How can you get a rope big enough to go around the universe? I have a doubt. This objection may be answered in this verse by the word martya lingam. Lingam means body. In order to perform His pastimes, the Supreme Personality of God had appeared like an ordinary human being. So although he's all-pervasive, He appeared as if a mortal, a martya lingam, like one of us. So because He appeared like one of us, it's just a pastime, but He appeared like one of us so the rope could go around Him. In order to act like an ordinary human being, the Supreme Lord allowed Himself to be bound by Mother Yashoda's rope. Okay? He appeared like an ordinary human being. So the rope could go around Him. At this point, a skeptic may raise the following question. Well, if the Supreme Personality of Godhead has a human-like form, then that form is certainly manifested within a limited area of space. How can such a limited form be all-pervading? You got it? It's like a chess game or something. Okay, He has a human-like form, human-like means. It's within a confined space. But there's this understanding that He's all-pervading. So how can He be in a confined space and all-pervading at the same time? This question is answered by the use of the word adhokshajam. Adhokshajam means beyond perception of the senses. The form of the Personality of Godhead cannot be properly understood by the senses of the conditioned soul, nor can it be understood by any other process for acquiring knowledge available to the conditioned souls. Not by speculation, the ascending process, not by mystic yoga, not by study of the Vedas. He's not accessible that way. But he's at Hokshajam, he's beyond the senses, which includes the mind. Because he is thus inconceivable, although he may appear to be limited within time and space, an actual fact, he's not. He's all-pervading. And as far as the time factor, he's not limited by time either. Neither time nor space limit him. So he can appear in a childlike body, at the same time be all-pervading and timeless. Because he is not properly understood by ordinary living entities, he is therefore described in this verse as avyaktam. Where's the word avyaktam? The last word in the second section, the end. So, avyaktam in this case means to the material senses that the reality of him is not perceivable. Although with spiritual senses he's perceivable. And we'll hear some more about that in another verse, the Premanjana Charita verse. So at this point, our friend the skeptic, he doesn't give up very easily. Very persistent. Well, if the Supreme Personality of Godhead is all-pervading, even though his form appeared like that of an ordinary human being, then why did he not reveal his all-pervading nature to his mother Jasoda? He could have just said, hey, Mother Jasoda, I'm all-pervading. You don't have to tie me up. And not only that, you know, I'm the Supreme Person. You don't need to, you know, discipline me. Take it easy, Mother Jasoda. Everything's copacetic. This question is answered by the words Atmajam Matva. That is, Mother Jasoda considered Krishna her own ordinary child. The relationship between Sri Krishna and Yashoda Devi was that of son and mother. In order not to disrupt the blissful exchange of love between himself and his mother, Lord Krishna concealed his all-pervasiveness and his other opulences from her eyes. Krishna can exhibit, Krishna can withdraw at his will. He doesn't even have to do anything. He just wills it in. There's his opulence and there's the withdrawal of his opulence. So he was exhibiting his all-pervasive feature by the rope not being able to go around him. Then he withdrew that all-pervasive feature, although he's all-pervasive, so Mother Jasoda could bind him. And that's how we can understand these irreconcilable contradictions. Very nice, isn't it? Mother Yashoda's ignorance of his superhuman prowess was actually her great glory. For in order to keep the loving parent-child relationship with her, Krishna allowed himself to be bound by a few small ropes. So within this Leela, and with the help of Jiva Goswami, we can understand from yet another angle or perspective how it is, and this is like a summary of our section that we're discussing, how it is that Krishna's pastimes are like they are. It's not imaginative. It's loving exchange between Krishna and his devotees, the devotees and Krishna. Krishna does amazing things. And the devotees do amazing things. And it's all made possible by the medium of bhakti, the exchange of love between the all-powerful object of love and one who is feeling love towards that object of love. Vishaya and Ashraya in the language of rasa. He is present in his fullness in every one of the atoms that are scattered throughout the universe. This is depicting a verse from Bhagavad Gita, where a learned person sees, although matter is configured in different ways all over creation, that which is animating matter is the soul. And the soul has the connection with Krishna. And within that soul, there's the super soul pictured at the top of the painting. So that same super soul is within the heart of every living being. And he's within every atom. He's literally all pervasive throughout the universe. Govindam Adi Purusham Tamaham Vajami. So we finished that section, and we're ready after breakfast for the next section. We're here at the beginning of the connection between the two. Any comments or questions? Yes?
Maharaj, there are two questions online from Giriyadita Singh Mataji. She asks, what practical steps should devotees with jnani tendencies take to increase deep bhakti in their heart?
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. The chanting of the holy name, the regular hearing, just like we're doing, of the glories of Krishna from the proper sources. And with that comes also, as we're doing, any acknowledgement that jnani tendency isn't going to get me where I want to go. You got a brake pedal, you got a gas pedal, and a steering wheel. That's recommended. So, and be patient with yourself if one has such a tendency, and continue to grow bhakti through the means of growing bhakti, as mentioned.
The second question is, how should devotees dovetail their own little will to Lord Krishna's supreme will?
The last section of Brahma Samhita describes that very beautifully, so she can read that section and listen to the recordings discussing that section. But the short of it is two things. One, purify oneself by the direct means of devotional practice. You know, or sadhana bhakti. Engage oneself in sadhana bhakti sincerely and with a calling unto Krishna to please take us to him once again. And then the other is recognizing tendencies. We have our psychophysical nature, so we have a tendency to do this or to do that. And the advice that Krishna gives to Brahma is to dedicate those things, tendency things, unto Krishna. So she has her occupation, and that instant indication of tendencies. She has her husband and her children. It indicates tendencies. So dedicate those things into the service of Krishna. Connect those things. Bhaktisiddhanta uses the word dovetail. It's my propensity. But if my propensity is offerable, let me offer it with devotion. And that the devotional inclination is aroused through the devotional practices. So I do the devotional practices and connect my propensity with the mood of devotion. That's the dovetail term. And then gradually, according to what Krishna says, those same tendency activities, the worldly activities, become as liberating as the direct devotional activities. That's the teaching that Brahma Samhita gives about this. We shouldn't, as Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, we shouldn't perform another's duty, even if it's done perfectly. Better you do your own duty, even if it's done imperfectly. So recognize what tendencies are. Offer them to Krishna. Dedicate them to Krishna. with devotion. And gradually, the tendencies, they may not change, but they'll simply become elevated and purified to the topmost platform. Anything else? Yes?
I have a comment and a question.
Mr. Sarasvata Prabhu provided a very, very wonderful insight into this verse. If you permit, I can try to share that.
All right, yeah, you got a microphone.
It really struck me very strongly. So, what he said was that if we take like a point as a one-dimensional point, then when we go want to connect it to another point, then we can draw a straight line in one dimension. Then if we go into two-dimensional space, then one point can be connected to two points in the two dimension. Similarly, if we go into three dimensions, then one point can be connected to three points, and that's three-dimensional, that gives the rise to three-dimensional space. And then it becomes harder to imagine, but he was explaining in his lecture, he probably was showing the picture of a tetrahedron where he said, when you go into four dimensions, then each point is directly connected to four different points. And then he extended the argument that in according to this verse 35, where it's mentioned that Krishna is present in every atom in his fullness, and within Krishna is the entire creation. That means every point can be connected directly to every other point in the whole universe. And that's infinite dimensional. So we kind of max out at the fourth dimension and cannot think beyond it. And in this way, Krishna is actually infinite dimensional. One way to even try to even mention it, or even, you know, it's impossible to conceive. But that kind of way that he explained that was something really striking to me. That's one thing I want to mention.
The physicists, that is a branch of study called theoretical physics, and they really get on their speculation jet and go zoom, zoom, multidimensional space. You know, the thing that makes it speculative is Krishna is not there. That point which connects all other points is missing. Anything else?
I have a question also.
You have a question also?
In the translation by Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, he has mentioned all universe exists in him, and he is present in his fullness in every one of the atoms that are scattered throughout the universe. So is there any special significance to the phrase that Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj has added about in his fullness?
Of course, everything he does is, as we said yesterday, it's very precise. He knows what he's saying, and he says it, and he means what he says. He says what he means, and he means what he says. So yes, he uses this other language that's called his subjective portion. It's not a psychological term, you know, subjective. It's a term that means his own expansion. So his own expansion is in his fullness, like, you know, candle lighting another candle. Candle number two is in the same fullness as candle number one. Potency-wise, we had this discussion about the six qualities, the four qualities of Krishna that are not within his expansions. But otherwise, Paramatma is the same tattva as Krishna, same category in his fullness, as distinct, let's say, from the living entity or from Lord Shiva that's not in his fullness, although it's also an expansion from him, making that distinction. Right? Yes. Microphone on the lady's side. Quickly.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. Maharaj, I was thinking one thing, when we leave our body, the soul goes, then it is covered by mind, intelligence and ego.
Subtle body, yeah.
Yes, subtle body. And I think during today's lecture, I think you mentioned that mind is a material element, yes, along with the senses. It cannot touch the spiritual world.
Yeah.
And I'm also thinking that whatever activities we are doing here, chanting and everything, we meditate, we think during chanting, as was discussed before, that sometimes we meditate on past tense of Krishna, that is through our mind. And we want to imagine that, and then here we are saying that mind cannot touch the spiritual world. So.
Got it. Seems like a contradiction, doesn't it? From what we've read, can you think of the answer?
Yes, ma'am.
What's the answer? The answer is, when the mind is the recipient, when the soul is the recipient, then the mind will also become the recipient of Ladini Shakti and Shit Shakti. And then the spiritual nature of the mind, its natural connection with Krishna, is restored. The spiritual nature, the mind becomes spiritualized. Okay, you got it? And the senses also. Now it's not that when the verse that says you can see Krishna through the medium of bhakti, it's not with these senses. It's the, we'll see when we get there, but it's the eye of the soul. But so the soul has mind, intelligence, and ego. There's spiritual senses. There's spiritual mind, there's spiritual intelligence. When the spiritual mind and spiritual intelligence become again activated, because now they're dormant, it spiritualizes this one and this one, and then they can act in a spiritual way. If you really want, like, a super exhaustive answer to your question, chapter 87 of Canto 10. It's the longest chapter in the entire Srimad Bhagavatam. And you'll need 3 dictionaries for that one. Prayers by the personified Vedas. Same question you asked is asked, different language, but same. The essence of that question is asked by Maharaj Pariksit to Shukadeva Goswami, and he gives his elaborate answer.
I read that in Krishna book and I didn't understand
anything. Yeah. The essence is what I just said. The essence is the senses are material, but because they're from Krishna, this inseparableness of verse 35, when connected to Krishna in devotion, the key is devotion, then their spiritual nature is restored because they're from Krishna. Spiritual nature is restored, and then the ear can act spiritually, the tongue can act spiritually, the mind can act spiritually. Although they're material, they become spiritualized. Their spiritual nature is restored.
So again, this is a gradual process as we continue on this process.
I've noticed that. Yes, it's definitely a gradual process. Like you mentioned the other day, like the rising of the sun. It's a gradual process. Exactly how Prabhupada compares. Gradual process. Doesn't have to be, but it is because we're attached. That's why it's gradual. And the less attached, more swift, more attached, more gradual. But it's going to act nonetheless, attached or not attached. Because there's potency within hearing the topics that we're hearing, within the holy name, within the worship of the deity, within honoring prasadam. There's potency, spiritual potency. So we're exposing ourselves to that chit shakti and madhini shakti by what we're doing. Gradually.
Hare Krishna. Maharaj, I have a question regarding jnanis.
About jnanis?
Yes, ma'am.
Really?
Is it possible to combine jnana and bhakti?
Sure.
That is to read books regarding Ram and Krishna and continue to do it.
Well, that's not jnana. That's bhakti.
Even reading books?
Yes. That's not jnana, that's bhakti. Jnana is different. Jnana is without, jnana is relying on the power of speculation to understand. When we read books about Krishna and Ram, we're eager to receive descending knowledge about Krishna and Ram. It's not an ascending, it's a descending process. So we need to make the distinction like this gradual process. It's not like there's a bucket over here, and there's a bucket over there, and you're either in this bucket or that bucket, take your bucket. It's not like that. Bhakti can be mixed with karma and jnana, but pure is unmixed. No karma. Jnana karma jnanavritam. Right? You familiar with the verse? That's bhakti. Bhakti is pure. And so we're in this mix. We want to enjoy fruit of activities. And we have this like really trained up tendency trying to understand things by figuring it out. We're trained up. We're rewarded handsomely since childhood to do that. It's like really strong tendency to speculate, to understand things, the ascending process. We're mixed. The reality is we're mixed. And to get to the unmixed, we cultivate on the bhakti side and we diminish the other side. Okay?
But doesn't Srila Prabhupada define bhakti as devotional service? And so I always thought that it was cleaning the kitchen or doing work like that.
Okay, but that's a very limited and narrow conception. Let's think of the nine processes of devotional service. They begin with Shravanam Kirtanam. That's devotional service. It's not like the people in the kitchen are doing devotional service and we're doing can. We're not distributing Bhagavad Gita's to people to engage them in can yoga. No way. We're engaging them in the process of bhakti, hearing the words of Krishna from the pure devotees. Voila. Bhakti begins. You know, the kitchen work begins with hearing and chanting. Whatever the cleaning the floor and whatever it is, it's not here's the devotional service arena and over here is the jnana arena. That's a misunderstanding. Yes.
Well, this is a theoretical question.
Theoretical question.
There are. Like yesterday you were mentioning about Achyuta.
About which? Achyuta?
The word Achyuta.
Achyuta.
Yeah, like, so you were mentioning that the devotees also don't fall down.
Yeah, you like that one, huh?
Yeah. So the...
But you know what you have to do? You have to be connected to him then you won't fall down.
Yeah. So the 15th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, so Krishna explains that there are two types of living entities. One who is infallible and the other who is fallible. So my question is, like, there are devotees in the entourage of the Lord who always come and perform pastimes with the Lord. So are there like two types of living entities, one who never fall down and one who may fall down? And
sure.
There's a nitya stita and there's a nitya vaibha.
I'm just wondering how some never fall down and why some would fall down.
They properly use their free will and some misuse their free will. We're in the second category. But some don't. In fact, the vast preponderance of living entities don't. We're this little minority group in jail because we misused our free will. The jail is this body. There's no bars and key, it's this body. That's the jail, the prison. We're prisoners. Okay, thank you very much, Prabhupada Ki. 1 hour?